Joining us right now in studio is Victor DeMasi, who was an extremely active member of the pollinator pathway, something you and I have spoken about for years now. He was a wetland conservation officer in his hometown of Reading for 20 years. He currently is a curatorial affiliate at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History in New Haven. One of his passions is to preserve open space in town and preserve butterflies in the museum. His butterflies and his collection of butterflies have been sighted in many, many places. He and his wife, a photographer, have been to the Amazon forest in Guyana, Nicaragua, and they've done yearly studies in a region of California that assesses the impact of climate change there. If you're lucky, you can take a walk through his own pollinator meadow here in Fairfield County in Reading. Victor DeMasi, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show, and good morning.
Well, thank you for having me on, Lisa, and you know, as a bug man, we don't get a lot of dates. I had trouble getting them in college, you know.
Oh, you're the second bug man we've had on the show this week. We had Douglas Tallamy on last week.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know his work?
Oh, of course I do, yes. And I think he's doing a great job.
Amazing.
Waking people up to stuff. And
That oak tree book is phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. So we're trying to do the Doug Tallamy on a small scale in
Good.
Reading.
Yeah.
We've got a two-acre meadow, which my wife, Rowanna, has really commandeered the preservation of. And we have located over the 45 years we lived there about half the state fauna of butterflies. So it's a very rich area. Several very rare butterflies occur there. And I happened upon the house years ago when I was first getting married, and I was a refugee from Stanford, and we were all moving to Reading. And a real estate agent, Marilyn Sloper, took me around all day looking at houses to rent, and she was getting a little hot under the collar when she didn't get any hits, and she finally said, "Well, Victor, I have one that's a real dog, but it just might be right for you." And I drove up the driveway and saw that two-acre meadow in the back, and I've been there 45 years.
So has it always been a meadow?
Yes. Yeah,
and what is a meadow?
Well, a meadow, this is hard to really describe in Connecticut. The state was so heavily cleared, about 90% during pre-colonial times. And these areas grew back as the state was deserted for Western areas, and these open areas persisted, which are called meadows.
Because they don't have big trees in them? Is
yes,
that the
right.
difference?
They're completely open.
They're open.
They're
and
open.
They're beautiful.
They are.
So
and
beautiful.
They're not lawns.
They're not lawns.
No, they're not lawns. That's the difference. There is a aspect of wildness.
Yes.
And just letting it happen. Now, ours was a deserted apple orchard. And the stuff came in, and now there's lots of goldenrod and all sorts of native flowers.
Black-eyed Susans?
There are black-eyed Susans, which is a
daisies.
Tremendous. Yeah, we have daisies. We have turtlehead, which is a wonderful, rare plant in Connecticut. All sorts of asters. We changed. We used to mow it every October to keep the woody growth down, and we changed that now. And in the last few years, we don't do any mowing. It's just hand weeding. And asters, fall asters, are just making a huge comeback. They're all over the place.
But you're not getting little oak trees and things that might take over the meadow?
Oak trees, and Doug Tallamy, I hope you're not listening to this, oak trees come out. We do get seedlings.
You do. Well, because you want to preserve the meadow.
Yeah, no, we want to open meadow. I mean, Doug would understand that 100%.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
So,
and what kind of insects, well, tell me about butterflies. Do butterflies love meadows?
Well, they do. Butterflies need two things to live. They need a food plant, like the monarchs feed only on milkweeds.
Milkweed.
And
I got to plant some.
Yeah, all the other – well, I have seeds, Lisa, so if you contact me, I will give you native seeds.
Really?
Because we want to have native seeds to Connecticut.
Okay. Do I bury them or just spread them?
You should start them in pots. My favorite method is I start them in small pots, and I bury them under my leaf pile starting maybe December.
Wow.
And a lot of them will germinate that way, and you know, then you grow them in pots maybe the first season, and then after that you can transplant them. But I wouldn't try direct ground sowing unless you have a huge amount of seeds.
Because otherwise they'll be eaten, right?
They're really tasty.
They're tasty.
I mean, even when we stored them in the barn in the first few years we were collecting them, the mice would get in and
just gobble. Yeah,
yeah,
not interested. More food for the mice.
Right,
no,
right. Mice are doing well.
Interesting. We're chatting with Victor Demasi. If you got a question about butterflies, 203-333-9422. So tell us. So the butterfly needs food, milkweed, okay?
Yep. And the adult butterfly needs nectar. So you have things like the tiger swallowtail, big yellow and black swallowtail butterfly, one of our big ones. You know, monarch gets all the attention, but the swallowtails are really wonderful. And the tiger swallowtail, the caterpillars feed on tulip tree and black cherry, which are basically forest trees.
Okay.
But they come into the meadow to nectar. So you have the two things. You need the forest and you need the meadow if you want to have a healthy population.
And the nectar is, you're saying, the bees with the asters and everything else
in the meadow? The tiger swallowtails, they like all the milkweeds for nectar. The swallowtail...
Oh, they go right into the milkweed to eat it.
No, to feed it the flowers.
Okay.
They take nectar and they become pollinators. Not because they want to be, but they just happen to brush up on the pollen. And as they're going around stealing nectar from all the flowers, they transfer the pollen from one to another. So they're passive. They're passive pollinators. Things like bees are active pollinators. They have special adaptations on their body.
That's their job. So, Victor Demasi, when I was a kid, I read that the life cycle of a butterfly is 6 days. Is that true?
I don't even know how to answer that. You take the monarch. Monarch takes about 6 weeks to develop from egg to adult.
Right, but I mean once they're a butterfly.
Well, once they're a butterfly, it's a tough place out there. Things like tiger swallowtails, if they live a week, they're lucky.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I heard about 6 days. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, that's in that context.
That's what I mean. You're absolutely right.
They're just bird food. So
is that right?
Yeah, the birds are chasing them.
The birds eat the butterflies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I did a mark recapture for 23 years. You go out and you capture the butterfly, and then you mark it somehow with a number.
You could mark a butterfly?
You write a number on it. And near your swallowtail flies by, and it's number 323. And you have a record of that butterfly, and you can figure out how long it's been around. And you can also look at the wings and see if there's any damage. So you can gauge if the birds have tried to eat it, but it got away.
But how do you know? How likely are you to ever see that butterfly again?
You're likely about 30%.
Really?
Yeah, I got about 30% recaptures on about 7,000 butterflies over 23 years. It's one of the longest studies, field studies of insects there is.
That you've done, Victor Demasi.
Yes, I did it. I did it, Lisa.
And you don't do you do this for money or for passion
no,
and
I
love
did
as
that
a true naturist?
I just did that for passion.
For passion.
I love, yeah. And it worked well with my butterflies. I took a degree in zoology, but I started painting for my mother when I got back from the Peace Corps in Ethiopia. And other people started asking me, and before I knew it, I had a paint company with employees, and then we started doing decorative artwork. And
so that's how you make a living.
That's how I made a living.
Okay.
I'm retired now,
okay.
But we traveled all over the United States, worked for National Park Service, Historic Restoration, and butterfly murals were my specialty. And if you drive by my house in Reading, you'll know it right away because there's butterflies painted on it, huge butterflies.
On your house?
On my house. And my wife, after the last one, she said, okay, that's enough.
Did you do the painting, like the actual painting?
Yeah, I did. It's all, you know, huge monarch, the monarch on the...
It must be very cool.
It's a lot
you know,
of fun.
Off air, you're going to have to give me your address.
Okay.
I'm going to have to go by, because I don't live far from... I'm on the Wilton border of Westport. Right
yes.
off 33.
Oh, okay.
I'm 20 minutes from Reading.
Okay.
You know where I go a lot, which I love, I don't go enough, is that gorgeous state park up there. the hunting
team. Oh, Huntington. We do a lot of hiking,
I love it there.
That's where we're there all the time.
What a gorgeous place that is, and the horses are there and everything.
Right. No,
just gorgeous.
It's wonderful. That has an interesting history, too, with Anahia Huntington, the sculptor and everything.
So explain to us, what is the pollinator pathway, and how can we be a part of it?
Well, the pollinator pathway is an idea started by Louise Washer, a wonderful person from Wilton, to restore native habitats and promote native flowers, which we're losing at an alarming rate. And it's important also because the flowers promote the pollinating insects, which are just declining inexplicably for several reasons, actually, we suspect. And we want to bring them back. And healthy insect populations also mean healthy bird populations.
And we've lost so many birds.
We have lost so many birds, and especially the insect-eating birds are really suffering because the insects are declining. So we have broad declines over insect groups. And one of the things, traditional studies of pollinating insects did not really, they're in collections and stuff like the Museum of Natural History, but they're not, we didn't know what flower they were collected at. So one of our modern things that we want to do is make that right and figure out what's pollinating what.
Mm.
For instance, you take things like the Monardas, the bee bombs, they have very deep flowers, and only the spicebush swallowtails and hummingbirds visit them, and they're doing
the
pollinating.
You mean like those lemon balm bushes that we have?
They're red, they're waist-high, floral, red, strikingly red.
Like the burning tree ones in the fall, the ones that turn red?
No, these are just garden flowers.
Really? Okay.
And bee balm.
Bee balm. I don't know it. Okay.
Yeah, it's very nice, but promotes only certain pollinators.
I see.
So we're looking at our meadow, and we're trying to connect the insect with the flower.
I see.
Because this information, it does not really exist. The people who work traditionally on pollinating insects didn't record much
so
about.
So you're doing that.
We're trying to do that.
And what should we, one lawn at a time, Victor Demasi, what should we have? What simple few necessities should we all have on our little bit of an eighth acre, quarter acre, 1 acre, 2 acres to promote the pollinator pathway?
Well, this is a wonderful question, Lisa, and I see it happening. One of the things is what I call let it grow, which is just letting your lawn go till the first week of July. And,
you want it till the first week of July?
Yeah,
because I'm doing No Mow May. You want me to do No Mow May June?
I go the 1st of July, and the picture of my lawn is often on Pollinator Pathway website and announcements. What I found, and because I'm keen on the pollinators, is a tremendous return of insects to my front lawn. And these are all going into the Peabody Museum. I'm not all of them, but I've made a sample of them, and they're going in as a reference collection. So, and you're seeing a lot of really interesting insects come back. Things like bumblebees are on my front lawn, of the metallic bees, which are absolutely striking if you can turn your scale down a little bit and appreciate small things.
Likely to sting us, Victor?
The solitary bees are not likely to sting. In fact, all bees are unlikely to sting when they're at when they're out doing their pollinating.
Yeah, they're busy.
Most insects that most Hymenoptera, this is the name of the group, most Hymenoptera that sting are when you're around their home, their hive, their place like that. You know, if you don't really disturb them when they're out of flowers, they're very easy to observe and they're not really aggressive. So
what about wasps?
Wasps will not really generally attack unless you're near their place where they're nesting.
Are they a useful insect at all?
They're pollinators.
Are they?
Yeah, they are pollinators.
I don't like wasps.
Many wasps control also noxious insect groups by taking the insects and using them as food
They eat mosquitoes and things?
I am having trouble answering that. I don't really know if they've taken a lot of mosquitoes from wasps, you know, the potter wasps and the paper wasps. I don't know if they're finding mosquitoes. But mosquitoes are one of the really interesting groups in the sense that I do a lot of displays. Like recently, I was up at the Inland Wetland meeting in New Haven, and one of the things that really astounds people talking about pollinators is that mosquitoes are pollinators, and male mosquitoes don't take blood; they only take pollen. So,
in other words, male mosquitoes are not going to bite us. Females are.
Only females. Isn't that typical? You know, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You
shouldn't be saying that on the radio.
All right.
But the males take pollen and nectar as a food source, and they, not meaning to, but they inadvertently pollinate plants as they go around from flower to flower.
Wow.
So this is a biology that, you know, a lot of people are not aware of.
So let me go back, because we only have a few minutes, Victor DeMasi. So one lawn at a time. First, it starts for you with not mowing.
Right.
You don't want us to mow.
Right.
If there were a couple of bushes that we were going to be planting anyway that would be more helpful, what would they be?
Well, I like lilacs.
I have a lilac tree.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Those are good shrubs. And the thing I like about lilacs is they provide spring nectar.
Okay.
Usually about the end of May, early June, they're in full bloom.
And they smell good.
They smell good, and they're beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. So lilacs are a good spring plant. Some of the mint family are good.
I love mint.
Pollinator Pathway offers a really detailed breakdown of plants that you could use to promote this. And when the pandemic started, we were, of course, faced with the idea of being stuck inside or not being able to do anything. So we started a survey of with a young biologist, Sammy Riccio. We started doing a pollinator survey in Reading at the Highstead Arboretum and on our meadow. Okay. And we went out every week and collected every single insect we could find at flowers. Not every, but mostly. And those collections are going to the Peabody, so they are, yardsticks of what a meadow might have now, 2022 in Reading, Connecticut. So those might someday, they will probably be very valuable collections someday as a reference.
Victor DeMasi, do you think that nature will respond relatively quickly to our trying to reverse some of our damage?
I think it will, because you look at things like the osprey.
Mm.
We stopped with the DDT, and they came back there. And eagles are booming.
Eagles, amazing.
So nature, I think, is resilient. Something's going to come to fill in the hole. And I think my main concern is pesticides. I'm really worried about the indiscriminate use of pesticides.
Me too. I ask virtually every single politician on the radio with me here on WICC, what are you going to do about pesticides?
Right.
And I get the humina, humina, huminas.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have big lobbying groups there pushing pesticides. The disturbing thing about pesticides, Lisa, is we only started recently using them. In our lifetime, they became ubiquitous. Not before.
Look at all the hormonal disturbances.
Right. We could go on.
Please.
We could go on for a long time. But one thing we did, Lisa, I just want to maybe bring this up real quick. For 27 years in Reading, every year we went around and we, on the 4th of July or near the 4th of July, we counted all the butterflies we could find. And this is called the 4th of July butterfly count, and it's done nationwide. Now, 27 years later, we have a yardstick what butterflies are doing every year in Reading. And we've noted some that we've lost. We've noted some that we've actually
nationwide,
gained.
It's been terrible.
Right, right.
How's Reading doing?
Reading is in decline, but it's not as precipitous as other places are experiencing. And as I said, we do have some new additions because we get maybe you want to say warmer climate butterflies are moving in.
They're adapting.
So for a biologist, of course, that's very interesting. I mean, I still go out in my backyard and find lots of interesting things to keep me busy. So and keeps me from despair, actually. So, but think about the osprey. Osprey came back. I think we can make the rest of it come back.
Yeah, we have to be optimistic, right?
We do.
We do.
We do.
I mean, I hear about a billion birds disappearing from the planet since the 70s. I want to break my heart.
It is.
And a lot of it is night lighting.
Night lighting is another issue. You know, we could also, there's a whole bunch of interlocking issues going on here. Asphalt, night lighting, lawning. The lawning in Reading in the 40 years that I've lived there is amazing.
Lawning, you know, as a verb? I've never heard it as
a verb
before.
It's now a verb.
Okay.
It's now a verb,
All
Lisa.
All right, Victor DeMasi, thank you very much for joining us today. Happy Thanksgiving.
And same to you, Lisa. Thanks.
Keeping with our conversation about the natural world around us, I saw the Connecticut Insider did an article on our next guest, Angela Pulo, of Mew Haven Cat Cafe in New Haven, being the first of its kind in the state. Angela joins us right now. Hi, Angela.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, obviously, you're a cat person.
Yes, very
right?
much so.
You're a cat person. And so, tell us a little bit, what is this cafe? If I were to drop by, what am I going to experience?
You are going to experience 20-plus cats as well as delicious coffee.
Okay.
We act as an adoption center. We are foster for Halfway Home Rescue, so all the cats that you see are up for adoption. So you just to come and hang out and order a beverage.
So you're feeding 20 cats a day?
Yes. Yes, we are. That can be quite chaotic, if you can imagine.
And are the cats already spayed or neutered?
Yes. Everyone is up to date on their shots. They are fixed. They are also microchipped, so they are adoption ready.
They're ready. They've had their rabies shots and everything else.
Absolutely.
And obviously, you have to check them for disease and feline distemper and
everyone
all that good stuff.
Everyone is super healthy, and our staff is so well experienced in making sure everyone stays healthy.
You know, one of the things, Angela, talk more into the mic, please. So one of the things that we know Connecticut really seems to care about is our dogs, but a lot of animal rescue organizations have told me that we could do a lot better when it comes to our cats.
I think cats can be misunderstood. You see a lot of them on the street. You think that they can take care of themselves, but they are just as prone to illnesses. They're just as prone as to other attacks. And not all cats should be outdoors. We do have a number of FIV positive cats, which means that they're immunocompromised. And so these cats should be maintained inside. So that way, if they're immunocompromised, you are more likely to get infections. So these cats are taken care of. We have some of them in our cafe. And
FIV? What is FIV?
Feline immunocompromised disease.
I didn't even know there was such a thing for
cats.
Yeah,
it is. It is possible. But the lovely thing about it is that they don't have to be kept separate from those without FIV.
Oh,
it's
that's
not
nice.
Easily passed along unless if there's like a serious outdoor aggressive fight. So these cats who may not find a home because people are not as educated about FIV, they can learn about them and fall in love with the cats and be educated and take them home.
So what's the average age of the cats that you have there? Are they all different ages or can anybody find a kitten?
All different ages. It really depends on who is available at the time because they do have to go through all the vet checks. At the moment, we have cats as young as 5 months. I think 7 years is the oldest right now. We've had cats as old as 12 years old. So honestly, all ages are looking for.
And how many cats have adopted out since you opened the cafe?
673.
Come on.
Yeah, we've been here for four years. It's a great number.
Come on.
It's a great.
Angela, you've been around for 4 years?
That's correct.
Oh, wow.
Honestly, it's due to the wonderful work of our rescue, Halfway Home Rescue. They've been around since 2004, and they care about every single animal. Not only do they adopt out cats and dogs and other small animals that they find, they also have a farm sanctuary for farm animals who need a place to stay. So on their facility, they have pigs and cows and ducks and chickens.
Are they located?
Oh, they're located in Woodbridge. They don't have a public facility, but they maintain their place in order to be able to take in animals who cannot find a home.
And so this is where you get the cats from?
This is where we get the cats from, yes.
And I guess there's no shortage of cats. I bet you'd like to go out of business. In a way. You know what I mean?
We have never run out of cats.
That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly. So, and if I were to come by the cafe and hang around, do you find that most people are coming there hanging around because they have an eye toward wanting to adopt a cat?
I would say a third of the people who come by already have it in their head that they could take home another cat. And if they fall in love with someone, they can fill out an application on the spot and we'll send that over to Halfway Home and get it processed.
And get it processed. And then Halfway Home decides whether or not it's a suitable family?
Correct.
That's really beautiful. What made you decide to do this?
Well, when I originally lived in New York, my husband and I had seen cat cafes open up there in 2014. It was wonderful. Meow Parlor was the first one we visited. At the time, also, Mike's cat had passed away, and we were not ready to adopt again. So after a few months of just feeling this out, he says, why don't we open one of our own? And I'm looking at him. Mike is not someone who just throws out ideas. I'm looking at him, and I'm like, why don't we take some time and research this and think about this? Can we make this possible? The next day, he says, Mew Haven. And I'm like, okay, forget it. This is it. Wait, this is a town that we're going to do it in.
You hadn't been in New Haven before?
Mike is originally from Connecticut. I am a Queens girl through and through.
Uh-huh.
So
what part of Queens?
Forest Hills was most recent. I grew up in Fresh Meadows.
Okay. Yeah. I know it well. My grandparents lived at 6545 Yellowstone Boulevard.
I know exactly where that is.
Yeah. And I lived in the shadow because I grew up in Woodmere. So, like, I'm right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right in the shadow of all the planes flying over JFK. But anyway, and so you came to Connecticut and Mew Haven as opposed to New Haven, and that's it. And what about your landlord? Is your landlord cool with all this stuff?
Our landlord is so incredibly supportive.
Really?
We actually were driving around looking at open properties, just looking through the windows and asking questions about whether anyone would accept animals. And we passed by this place with giant, gorgeous windows, and we're peeking in to see what could it look like. And all of a sudden, around the corner comes this woman, and she says, oh, are you interested in the property? And it turned out that was the landlord, and we arranged to look inside at a future visit. And when we told her about our idea, she was so incredibly supportive.
Really?
That's so
lovely.
Yes, yes.
Because I don't think every landlord would be. So it turned out to be the right match.
I mean, back in 2017, no one had really heard of a cat cafe. No one understood the concept of being able to go and visit with cats. Like, why would you want to visit cats? Don't you have cats of your own? But yes, those who love animals know there can never be enough.
There can never be enough. You know, there are two things that have been proven to lower our blood pressure. One is looking at the water, and the other is petting an animal.
Yes.
It's an instant relaxation for people.
Cats do not expect anything from you. They just want to be there.
Well, they scratch once in a while, though.
Well, that's why it's really wonderful to be able to ask our staff, well, can you tell me what this means when this cat is, his tail is swishing?
Mm.
His tail is swishing. He's a little bit annoyed.
Yeah, it's not like a dog. It's not like come play with
me.
No.
It's different.
I grew up with cats.
Yes.
Yeah. And my cat was like a dog. My cat followed me,
you know,
without a leash. I mean, he just followed me wherever I went all the time. Whenever I went outside, he followed me. And I loved that, and I missed him. But he thought he was a dog, and he had a fight with a German Shepherd, and he lost, and he died. Yeah. Yeah. I was in college freshman year. I cried like crazy. My mother didn't know how to tell me.
How old was it?
The cat?
Yeah.
10, because we got him when I was 8.
Yeah.
He was 10, and he thought he was a dog. But his name was Pussy. Because it was an innocent name then.
Yes.
What can I tell you?
Of course. I mean,
it was 8 years old. It was 1968. Leave me alone. That was his name.
We have all names for the cats. Don't worry about it. We literally have a cat right now named Kitty.
Yeah.
And our first cat adopted out was Hangersteak. So.
Okay. Hangersteak?
Hangersteak. Yeah. The people at the shelter were hungry that day. Hangersteak and Chicken Cutlet.
Chicken Cutlet. That's
they were brothers.
One of my favorite names of a cat, my really good friend, her cat's name was Big Dog.
That's
a great name. Big Dog. Come over here, Big Dog. But the thing about cats is they don't come when called. They are, according to the most famous animal trainer that I once interviewed, he actually trained Sandy, the dog, and Annie. Big, big famous guy from Connecticut. Bill, I forgot his last name. He told me the cats are not trainable.
Whenever people come in and they don't know anything about cats and they want to learn more, I tell them to approach it like a person. If you're approaching someone, let's say, you know, if you're out, you're at a bar, you don't just immediately go and hug someone. You don't know them. So you talk with them, you read their cues, you see if they're interested. If they look away from you, if a person looks away from you while you're talking to them, they're clearly not interested. And it's a similar manner of cats. If they're walking away from you, they're not interested in hanging out with you at that moment. That's okay.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, a cat is a different kind of an animal than a dog. They're just different, but they're wonderful companions.
They're wonderful companions.
Wonderful.
And when they want to hang out with you, they will come up to you.
Totally.
And they will not leave you alone.
Totally. Purring, rubbing. And do you have different breeds of cats, or because they're rescues, they tend to be your typical domestic short hair?
So we do have a variety of colors and a variety of breeds, but we can't tell what breeds they are. Some, like, they come with a sheet with them.
Right.
But certainly we just adopted out a cat who clearly has Siamese in him. We have cats who are very long-haired and very big paws, and people are saying, oh, that looks like a Norwegian forest cat. And I'm like, maybe.
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 Maybe. Maybe has a coon tail or some.
Yes.
Yeah. Beautiful. And how many cats do you have at home?
Myself?
Yeah.
I have one.
You have one.
I have one cat who is a solo cat. Yeah. When he was at the cafe, his name is Colossus now, he would walk away from other cats. There are kittens following him, saying, play with me, play with
no
me.
No interest.
He walked away.
He
groomed them, and he was very fine to be around them, but he
wasn't interested.
No.
No. Do you have kids?
I do.
Yeah?
Yeah, 3-year-old almost. That kid has learned how to, personal boundaries super well. He has learned how to pet gently. He knows the feeling of the cat. If the cat doesn't want anyone around him, he's learned. So it's a great thing to learn at a young age.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And do you work at the cafe?
Yeah, I'm there 2 or 3 times a week.
Yeah, and your husband too?
He maintains his 9-to-5, but he's there once a week.
Oh, he has another job too?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, we do what we can.
You do what you can. Right. You have to support your family. And other than coffee, what else could you get at the cat cafe?
So,
can you get a donut, a muffin? What can you get?
Yes, we have some baked goods like banana bread, cinnamon rolls, cat cookies, and cat cupcakes.
Naturally.
We work with local bakeries like Sweet Treats by Sonia and Molly's Bakery. They're wonderful. They're located in Beacon Falls. We also have a bevy of merchandise. We recently opened up online shipping. So you can get our 2013 calendar, Cats and Ties. I got to show you a picture later.
I would love to see it.
Dozen cats wearing bow ties.
Bow ties. Adorable.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. Do we have a caller for... I'm not sure. Andrew, do we have a caller for Angela? For our cat... No, something else. Okay. Angela of Muke Haven Cat Cafe, thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for facilitating the rescue of close to 700 cats in 4 years. It's really remarkable. And it's a beautiful thing. I'll have to come by myself and say hi. But without my husband, he's so allergic, you can't even imagine. But I'll come by myself. I'll have a good time.
Come. The best way to do it, especially during this busy holiday season, is to purchase tickets on our website ahead of time.
Oh, you just can't stop in?
If we have space, you can. But I know Thanksgiving is coming.
People book up the space because you don't have that many people at any one time allowed in.
We cap it so that way it's not too stressful for the cats. And also so you can get enough cat time. We want you guys to be able to enjoy all the cats and not have to bump into other people.
I love it. Thanks, Angela. Thanks for coming on the show. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.